So tonight I want to actually do a talk called The Dhamma of Loneliness. It's based partly on a chapter in Pema Chodron's book, When Things Fall Apart. And I wanted to do this talk tonight, which I have done before, because I keep reading more and hearing more, listening to NPR and things about how loneliness is becoming a bigger and bigger issue in our culture, partly because of our digital world that we all live in, where we're not actually physically, you know, connecting with people anymore. And partly because this is the season where people often struggle more with loneliness than in, say, in July. It's just because it's the holidays and people miss people that aren't there anymore or whatever. So that's why I wanted to talk about this. And part of this is about how we deal with, how we deal skillfully with feeling lonely. That's really what this talk is about. Because everybody feels lonely sometimes. There's no one I know that doesn't have bouts and times when they just feel that way. So this is, in some sense, about right effort, about how we can put in effort to work skillfully with our feelings of loneliness so that we don't get overwhelmed by them. And, of course, this is from a Buddhist point of view. And so this is, in Pema Chodron's book, this is called The Six Kinds of Loneliness. In the middle way, there is no reference point. The mind with no reference point does not resolve itself, does not fixate or grasp. How could we possibly have no reference point? To have no reference point would be to change a deep-seated habitual response to the world, wanting to make it work out one way or the other. If I can't go left or right, I will die. When we don't go left or right, we feel like we are in a detox center. We're a lone cold turkey with all the edginess that we've been trying to avoid by going left or right. That edginess can feel pretty heavy. However, years and years of going to left or right, going to yes or no, going to right or wrong, has never really changed anything. Scrambling for security has never brought anything but momentary joy. It's like changing the position of our legs in meditation. One leg hurts from sitting cross-legged, so we move. And then we feel, phew, what a relief. But 2.5 minutes later, we want to move again. And then again, we keep moving around seeking pleasure, seeking comfort. And the satisfaction that we get is very short-lived. We hear a lot about the pain of samsara, and we also hear a lot about liberation. What we don't hear much about is how painful it is to go from being completely stuck to becoming unstuck. The process of becoming unstuck requires a tremendous bravery. Basically, we are completely changing our ways of perceiving reality, like changing our DNA. We are undoing a pattern that is not just our pattern, it's the human pattern. We project onto the world a million possibilities of attaining resolution. We can have whiter teeth, a weed-free lawn, a strife-free life, a world full of without embarrassment. We can live happily ever after. This pattern keeps us dissatisfied and causes us a lot of suffering. So she's pointing to our habitual patterns of grasping and wanting, of wanting things to be, wanting things, or wanting things to be a certain way, or expecting them to be a certain way, or thinking they must be that way. And then when things don't work out, we were upset by the fact that they don't work out. And then Pema goes on. The experience of certain feelings can seem particularly pregnant with desire for resolution. Like, we always want to try to fix things, right? loneliness, boredom, anxiety. Unless we can relax with these feelings, it's very hard to stay in the middle when we experience them. We want victory or defeat, praise or blame. For example, if somebody abandons us, we don't want to be with the raw discomfort. Instead, we conjure up a familiar identity of ourselves as a hapless victim. Or maybe we avoid the rawness by acting out and righteously telling the person how messed up he or she is. We automatically want to cover our over the pain in one way or another, identifying with the victory or victimhood. Usually we regard loneliness as an enemy. Pema's quite brilliant. I think she says things like that so succinctly. Usually we regard loneliness as an enemy. Heartache is not something we choose to invite in. It's restless and pregnant and hot with the desire to escape and find something or someone to keep us company. When we can rest in the middle, we begin to have a non-threatening relationship with loneliness, a relaxing and cooling loneliness that completely turns our usual patterns upside down. So, all kinds of other tidbits from other teachers. This is just a little Hafiz poem. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut deep. Let it ferment and season you, as few humans or even divine ingredients can. So loneliness is just another emotional arising. And we feel like we don't like it, number one. It's unpleasant. So we want to fix it. And we keep trying to fix it doing different things. And instead, what this Hafiz is saying here and what Pema is saying is, oh, loneliness, it's like this. We have to sort of marinate ourselves in it, live with it, see what it's like, feel it, just like we have to feel any other strong emotion. Think about loneliness is it's so pointed to as being wrong. Just, it's wrong. And so it seems we're totally justified to do something about it right away, to fix it somehow or other. And what Pema's going to do here is basically point to the fact that that doesn't work. And then Pema goes on. There are six ways of describing this kind of cool loneliness. So, if we're going to be lonely, can we be cool lonely, as opposed to hot lonely? Hot lonely is, I want to fix it, God, there's something about it, oh, this is terrible. Cool lonely. There are six ways of describing this kind of cool loneliness. They are less desire, contentment, avoiding unnecessary activity, complete discipline, not wandering in the world of desire, and not seeking security from our own discursive thoughts. It's quite an interesting list, I think. Right. And so the rest of this talk, really, we're going to try and sort of look at these things. The first thing, we can have cool loneliness if we have less desire. Less desire is the willingness to be lonely without resolution when everything in us yearns for something to cheer us up and change our mood. Practicing this kind of loneliness is a way of sowing seeds so that fundamental restlessness decreases. So this is, you know, restlessness, one of the five kilesas she's talking about here, how loneliness and restlessness are so tightly related in our minds and in our reactive patterns. In meditation, for example, every time we label thinking, instead of getting endlessly run around by our thoughts, we are training in just being here without dissociation. We can't do that now to the degree that we weren't willing to do it yesterday or the day before or last week or last year. After we practice less desire wholeheartedly and consistently, something shifts. We feel less desire in the sense of being less solidly seduced by our very important storylines, all capitalized. There we are, sitting there meditating, and sure enough, some familiar storyline arises for the 37th time, and we run off with it because it's very important, right? It's like, oh, I have to figure this one out. So even in the hot loneliness, if the hot loneliness is there, and for 1.6 seconds we sit with that restlessness when yesterday we couldn't sit for even one, that's the journey of a warrior. So he's pointing to the fact that this is a practice that takes time, and we have to sort of, even if it's like just for a couple of seconds, we can just go, oh, this is okay. It's not pleasant, but it's okay. Then we're learning to have cool loneliness. We're not just rushing off to fix things right away. That's the path of bravery. The less we spin off and go crazy, the more we taste the satisfaction of cool loneliness. As the Zen master Katagiri Roshi often said, one can be lonely and not be tossed away by it. One can be lonely and not be tossed away by it. That's quite interesting, because that's what loneliness does. It tosses us away. We have to do something. I can't. There's something, or there's something wrong with me. I'm so lonely because no one wants to be with me. There must be something wrong with me. That's the other place we go. It's another version of the story, in a sense, right? This is a little more from Jack Kornfield. And this is, I'm talking about this thing of like when we're lonely and we judge ourselves, there's a, and this is a really, I love the, how he puts this so precisely. There's an addictive quality to my relationship to food, contact, sensuality, and a deeper unfulfilled loneliness. Unconsciously, I'm always trying to please people. Is one of the great causes of loneliness on the psychological level. We think, I have to sort of be with other people and be okay with them when they have to like me, which just pushes people away, that sort of neediness energy that often causes us to act that way. It just creates more loneliness, more sensations of loneliness. So the next thing that Pema talks about, next to less desire, sort of a different angle on the same thing, is called contentment. In both Pali and Sanskrit, this is called santosha. Yeah. The second kind of loneliness is contentment. When we have nothing, we have nothing to lose. We don't have anything to lose, but being programmed in our guts to feel that we have to have a lot to lose. Our feeling that we have a lot to lose is rooted in fear of loneliness, of change, of anything that can't be resolved, of non-existence. The hope that we can avoid this feeling and the fear that we can't become our reference points. When we draw a line down the center of a page, we know who we are if we're on the right side and who we are if we're on the left side. But we don't know who we are when we don't put ourselves on either side. Then we just don't know what to do. We just don't know. We have no reference point, no hand to hold. At that point, we can either freak out or settle in. Contentment is a synonym for loneliness, cool loneliness. settling down with cool loneliness. We give up believing that being able to escape our loneliness is going to bring any lasting happiness or joy, or sense of well-being, or courage, or strength. Usually we have to give up this belief about a billion times, again and again, making friends with our jumpiness and dread, doing the same old thing a billion times with awareness. Then, without our even noticing, something begins to shift. We can just be lonely with no alternatives, content to be right here with the mood and the texture of what's happening. Can we just experience what it is and not feel any need to fix it? None. This is what I got. It's okay. Can we just be there, sitting in that the middle? It's an interesting question we have to ask ourselves every time we start feeling that there's something wrong because I'm feeling lonely. There's nothing wrong. It's just, it's not right. It's not wrong. It just is. This is what's happening right now. Loneliness has arisen. Oh, that's okay. Isn't that interesting? That's okay. Without having to do anything other than just be aware of that's what's arisen right now. Then the next thing she talks about is avoiding unnecessary activities. Often when we're lonely, we get into the busyness. Oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do this. We start sort of running, as my old dad used to say, start running around like a chicken. Right? We have to do something. Because doing something will defeat my loneliness somehow or other. Right? This third kind of loneliness is avoiding unnecessary activities. When we are lonely in a hot way, we look for something to save us. We look for a way out. We get this queasy feeling that we call loneliness, and our mind just goes wild trying to come up with companions to save us from our despair. That's called unnecessary activity. It's a way of keeping ourselves busy so we don't have to feel any pain. It could take the form of obsessively daydreaming of cruel romance, or turning a tidbit of gossip into the 6 o'clock news, or even going off by ourselves into the wilderness. The point is that in all these activities, we are seeking companionship in our usual habitual way, using our same old repetitive ways of distancing ourselves from the demon loneliness. Could we just settle down and have some compassion and respect for ourselves? Can we stop trying to escape from being alone with ourselves? What about practicing not jumping and grabbing when we begin to panic? Relaxing with loneliness is a worthy occupation. As the Japanese poet Ryokan said, if you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after so many things. This is along the lines of talking about how important it is to simplify our lives. Often our lives, we get so busy because we're doing all these different things to avoid feeling just lonely. We keep adding more things to the list. So I'm busy all the time. Then I can't be lonely if I'm busy, right? Can we simplify our lives and sort of just be with and accept the fact that loneliness has arisen? This is related very directly to the idea of boredom, where like boredom is somehow bad as well, right? We think, oh, there's nothing worse than being bored. This is Joseph Goldstein from his book Insight Meditation. And he has a chapter here called Thank You Boredom, which seems like an oxymoron, right? Thank you, boredom. Like anger and other emotions, boredom often fools us into diverting our energies entirely to an external situation. Thus, it keeps us from liberating ourselves by seeing our relationship to the emotion itself. We make a great mistake about boredom when we think that it comes because of a particular person or situation or activity. So much of the restlessness in our meditation practice and in our daily lives derives from this fundamental misunderstanding. How often do we try to find something new to recapture our interest, something more stimulating or more exciting? If I just find a new good Dharma book, I'll be okay. I'll get excited about practice again. I'm guilty of that one. That's why I recognize it. To realize that boredom does not come from the object of our attention, but rather from the quality of our attention, is truly a transforming insight. Fritz Perls, one of those who brought Gestalt therapy to America, said, "Boredom is lack of attention." Understanding this reality brings profound changes in our lives. Then boredom becomes a tremendously useful feedback for us. It is telling us not that the situation or person or meditation object is something lacking, but rather that our attention at that time is half-hearted. Instead of wallowing in boredom or complaining about it, we can see it as a friend saying to us, pay more attention, get closer, listen more carefully. On my very first month-long retreat, about halfway through, I was getting really restless. And I'm like, oh my God, I've got 2 more weeks, and what am I going to do? And I was just, I was, you know, doing the practice, like, you know, trying to keep my mind on, you know, noting the breath and noting what's arising and following the instructions the teachers were giving. But I went into a practice meeting with my teacher at the time, Howard Kahn. And I said to him, I came in, I was just like wound up about this. And I said, this practice is so boring. And he just looked at me and he smiled very calmly and he waited a few seconds. This means you're not paying enough attention. And he was right, because he said, that's what you need to do. Like, you know, you're sort of skimming over, you're meditating, but you're skimming the surface. You're not really paying, not looking deeply enough into just what it takes to take a breath, for instance. Can you just take one breath and really pay attention to everything that happens in just taking a whole breath? And then you start getting fascinated by what is happening. And now you're paying more attention. And the boredom just disappears. The loneliness is gone because you're paying attention to what's happening right now. When we are with people and feeling bored, can we listen a little more carefully, stepping off the train of our own inner commenting? If we are sitting in meditation and feeling uninterested, can we come in closer to the object, not with force, but with gentleness and care? What is this experience we call the breath? If someone were holding your head underwater, would the breath be boring? Each breath is actually sustaining our life. Can we be with it fully, just once? When we recognize that boredom is what boredom is, it becomes a great call to awaken. So that loneliness we feel sometimes is because we're not tuning into what's going on all around us. Because we think it's boring. You know, I'm with these other people and they're blathering away and God, they're so boring. And that makes me feel lonely. I mean, that thought. Instead of like, let's really pay attention and notice what it is they're saying and listening to it, but also like pay attention to their body language and pay all attention to all the other ways that people communicate. And now that same, quote, boring thing that's going on becomes quite fascinating because there's so much to pay attention to when you really start to pay attention. We're just shifting how we think of things. This is another the next kind of loneliness that Pema is talking about. Complete discipline. Oh, there's people are flinching from that word already, right? Oh, discipline. Ugh. Complete discipline is another component of cool loneliness. Complete discipline means that at every opportunity, we're willing to come back, just gently come back to our present moment. This is the loneliness as complete discipline. We're willing to sit still, just be there alone. We don't particularly have to cultivate this kind of loneliness. We can just sit still long enough to realize it's how things really are. We are fundamentally alone. And there's nothing anywhere to hold on to. Moreover, this is not a problem. In fact, it allows us to finally discover a completely unfabricated state of mind. Our habitual assumptions, all our ideas about how things are, keep us from seeing anything in a fresh, open way. We say, "Oh, yes, I know," but we don't know. How often do we sit and in our mind, as we sit down to sit, we already know what's going to happen? It's a pretty strong habit that we have, where we think we know that what sitting is going to be like before we even start sitting. And the truth is, we really don't have a clue if we start really paying attention. Because it's going to be different every time because the causes and conditions are different in that moment. If we pay attention, we start to see all the differences. Every sitting becomes fresh. This is like that phrase, practicing with beginner's mind. It's like if every time we sat, we thought we were just a beginner doing it for the first time, how different would our practice be? We don't ultimately know anything. There's no certainty about anything. This basic truth hurts, and we want to run away from it. But coming back and relaxing with something as familiar as loneliness is a good discipline for realizing the profundity of the unresolved moments of our lives. We are cheating ourselves when we run away from the ambiguity of loneliness. I like that expression too. Another little tidbit from my friend Jack Kornfield. He's actually talking about his time as a monastic. Since my vows included celibacy, I had to wrestle with much stronger desires, especially powerful sexual fantasies. I was a young man, and I tried to notice these natural desires mindfully, but they kept returning with great energy. Because they were so strong, my teacher had me pay close attention to the states that came with the fantasy. He especially wanted me to notice how they arose. To my surprise, I discovered that preceding most of these fantasies were feelings of loneliness. I have always had difficulty with loneliness. I am a twin, and I suspect that I didn't even want to be alone in the womb. Accepting that loneliness was hard, but my teacher insisted I stay with it. As I explored the loneliness, I found insecurity and a needy kind of emptiness. Emotional energies that underlie a lot of our sense of loneliness, our insecurity, that, oh, I'm not interesting enough for anyone to hang out with me or be with me. Or all interesting people are off doing something fun, and here I am all by myself. we keep tricking ourselves into believing nonsense, essentially. As I explored the loneliness, I found insecurity and a needy kind of emptiness, that neediness of wanting something, anything, so that I wouldn't feel this loneliness. That's the opposite of what Pema is talking about here. This is yet another kind of loneliness. Not wandering in the world of desire is another way to describe cool loneliness. Wandering in the world of desire involves looking for alternatives, seeking something to comfort us, food, drink, people. The word desire encompasses that addiction quality, the way we grab for something because we want to find a way to make things okay. The quality comes from never having grown up. We still want to go home and be able to open the refrigerator and find it full of our favorite goodies. When the going gets tough, we want to yell, "Mom!" But what we're doing as we progress along the path is leaving home and becoming homeless. Not wandering in the world of desire is about relating directly with how things are. Loneliness is not a problem. Loneliness is nothing to be solved. The same is true for any other experience we might have. The key to that is loneliness is not a problem. Loneliness is nothing to be solved. But this is what we do over and we keep desiring things, physical things, experiences, whatever, as a way to not feel lonely. To mask it, to bury it away, to not pay attention to it because it's really unpleasant. And what she's saying is, no, just be with it. And so, because it's just something that arises and is there for a while and it's gone. Remember that too. Like everything else, loneliness arises. The energy, the feeling, the emotion of loneliness arises. It's there for a while. And then it's going to be gone. If we can just sit with it as opposed to fighting it. Fighting it just makes it stronger. Can we just acknowledge it? Hang out with it. Go, oh, this is what it feels like to be lonely. I came across this interesting verse in the Samyutta Nikaya. The Buddha's talking about people, how they practice alone in the forest, which is what he would always tell his disciples, you know, go sit in the forest by yourself. Right? Even though a bhikkhu who dwells thus resorts to forests and groves, to remote lodgings, where there are few sounds and little noise, desolate, hidden from people, appropriate for seclusion, is still called one dwelling with a partner. For what reason? Because craving is his partner, and he has not abandoned it. Therefore, he is called one dwelling with a partner. So no matter, if we're just thinking, oh, well, I can be still and quiet and everything's okay, but I'm craving for it not to be that way. That's just craving. That's all it is. Just wanting something to be other than what is there at this moment. And a part of this practice is learning to consciously choose to be alone, to be still, to be not around a lot of people or a lot of things that get us going. You know, so a lot of what retreat is about is going off, and even though you're with other people, you're not connected to them in any way other than physically in the same room, perhaps. And that's a choice to be lonely so you can really look at things And what happens, of course, is we start craving all kinds of things so that we don't feel lonely. How many times have I on retreat go, oh, I hope they have something good for lunch. Just anything to make this interesting somehow or other, right? Oh, I'll get, there'll be something great, don't worry. The cook here is really good, however I justify myself. So if we stop wandering in desire, if we stop and just let things be, and that allows us to be alone, to be with loneliness and be perfectly okay with that's what's going on. And here's the final one. I like this. This is a really good one. Another aspect of cool loneliness is not seeking security from our discursive thoughts. The rug's being pulled, the jig is up, and there's no way out of this one. We don't even seek the companionship of our own constant conversation with ourselves. But how it is or how it isn't, whether it is or whether it isn't, whether it should be or whether it shouldn't, whether it can be or whether it can't. With cool loneliness, we don't expect security from our own internal chatter. Even our habitual patterns of mind, which are discursive, and it's those stories and discussions and thoughts and what about this, oh, maybe this, maybe that, blah, 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 blah. It's a way to combat, force away, ignore the loneliness that's sitting there at the center of it all. The fact that you're alone sitting there meditating. That's why we're instructed to label it thinking. It has no objective reality. It is transparent and ungraspable. We're encouraged to just touch that chatter and let it go. Not make much ado about nothing. I love that. That's a great phrase. A little Shakespeare quote there in the middle of her talk. This is from the Book of Joy. This is the Dalai Lama talking about this topic. Actually, it starts with the person who, this guy Douglas Abrams, talking about how he grew up. Having grown up in Manhattan, surrounded by 7 million New Yorkers, I knew exactly what the Dalai Lama was saying. As a boy, I never really met the people who lived on our apartment floor. I would occasionally hear their doors close with an empty metallic bang and locks turn behind them. If we did see them while waiting for the elevator, few words were spoken and eyes were averted. I was always bewildered by this willful avoidance and finally concluded that it must have been a defense against the crush of so many people crowded together. We're human beings, the Dalai Lama said, returning to one of his most profound refrains. No need for introduction. Human faces, when we see one another, we immediately know that it is a human brother or sister. Whether you know them or not, you can smile and say hello. I thought of the times that I had smiled and spoken with warmth to the person waiting for an elevator or standing in a subway. Yes, sometimes my bid for human connection was met with confusion, since it was not the social expectation. But most often there was a relieved smile, as if we'd broken a trance and were once again acknowledging our human bond. Just allowing ourselves to make connection with people as often as we can. And it's just little things. I was thinking about this in this context. I'm a hospital chaplain one day a week, so, and you're always going up and down the stairs. I never take the elevator. I'm always going up and down the stairs between the floors, so it's a good exercise, right? But the doors are big, these big heavy doors. So you'll go to reach the door, and just as you're about to reach to open it or close it or whatever, it opens because someone else is there pushing it or pulling it or whatever, and you. Like, and you sure you, in the midst of a door opening, you'll meet someone. And I always, and maybe it's just by nature, but I always say something like, "Oh, isn't that great? That, thank you for opening the door for me." And just smile, and it's like just a little bit of human connection with people. And everybody, no one, every once in a while, someone's like, "Oh, what, who is this weird old guy, talking to me?" Well, almost everyone reacts with like, "Oh." And they smile back, and they'll say something back, and just like, and it's just like these pleasant little moments of connection that are there if we allow ourselves to make them. Which, and it's just little tiny things sometimes that make a huge difference. We connect to people as often as we can in little tiny ways. Fleeting as we both go opposite directions through the door, or walking down, there's lots of hallways you walk down in the hospital, and you're walking by and you see someone, you might sort of recognize them vaguely, and you sort of smile, and they smile, and you wave and say, "How are you?" or something. You don't say anything, you just sort of smile at each other as you go by. But just those little moments make a huge difference in terms of connecting at the heart level with people. So what I'm trying to get at, I guess, with this whole talk, and what Pema was getting at, is that our practice can lead to working much more skillfully with loneliness, not making it into something we have to avoid or something we have to fix, but something we can just acknowledge. Ah, this is what's, it's just another thing that arises, and it's there for a while, and then it's gone. Like everything else. It's just a part of being human. Every human in the world experiences loneliness from time to time. Or does everything they can to avoid. So we have to learn to not struggle with it, to calmly slow down, to pay attention, to intensify our awareness of it while not trying to figure it out. Why do I feel so lonely all the time? Boy, that's a fruitless thought pattern. We can't figure it out. It's just, that's what arises. And then we just learn to say, "Oh, this is okay. This is what's here, and it's okay." This is Ajahn Chah. He's talking about. And this is in a chapter he has in this book called The Most Important Thing, he calls Willingness to Encounter Silence. One of the first and most powerful aspects of meditation we encounter is its honesty. We are sitting down and facing ourselves. When we are in a quiet space free from external disturbance, like the television or conversation, you are alone with yourself. You can have all sorts of spiritual ideas, we all do, but when you are sitting still and being quiet, it's like gazing in a mirror. You are seeing yourself. When we meditate, what we are doing, at least initially, is noticing the contents of our mind and of our consciousness. We're alone with that. That's the nature of the practice, is to learn to be alone with the contents of our own mind. I find that thought kind of interesting too. And we have all kinds of ideas about, well, what meditation is going to be like, and I'm going to get to all these amazing states of mind and discover all kinds of amazing things. But really what we're doing is we're just learning how to be with the contents of our own mind. What arise? What's arising now? Oh, that. Oh, loneliness. Oh, fear. Oh, whatever. And that's okay. And loneliness is just something that we have to learn to say, that's okay. One last tidbit. This is from Dana Fald's book, One Soul. It's a poem. It's sort of tangentially related to what I was saying anyway. I just happen to like the poem too. It's called Beneath the Surface. What will I know if I go below the choppy surface of the mind? Focus flows, and there are no fixed points. Slow currents swirl and slip still deeper. I grow very quiet. The mind tends the subtlest sensations. It is a different world, and I am an explorer of these inner realms where nothing stays the same for very long. Energy shifts and changes. I find peace beneath the surface. Bring it back with me, hold it in my hand like a small white bird, and then release it, that peace might fly where it is most needed. Pretty good description of what we're trying to do. Just to go beneath the surface, see what's there. And often when we can see it, then we can hold it and be okay with it. And that affects how we are in the world, which is the most important thing about the practice from my point of view. So can we take this into the world and be useful in the world, just being calm and nothing else? Sometimes it's all we can do in the world.